Blog Talk Radio.
So I'm gon' drop you with the left, the left. I feel like I'm the last real nigga left, the left. It's like I'm on an island by myself, the left. Please don't make me slap you with the left, the left. You will fake, so I'm gon' drop you with the left, the left. I feel like I'm the last real nigga left, the left. It's like I'm on an island by myself, the left. God, please protect me if this shit go left. Cause I can cook a kilo by my goddamn self. In the kitchen, water whipping with the left. I don't know what man, but I know who got the mouth. I feel like I'm a woman being
son of a bitch.
Cause I can lock a trap down by myself.
What it do, people? Okay. So, goodness gracious. Alright, today, the NRA is going to surprise you with a new position that they're taking. We also have the UN resolution. We didn't get to it yesterday, but the United States did something just bonkers at the UN that's not getting anywhere near the amount of attention that it deserves. We have Alex Jones going so far off the rails that even his fellow co-hosts are like, dude, come on, man, stop, just stop. There's an amazing new poll out from Pew Research that really shows what Americans feel about a variety of issues, including foreign policy and religion, and I want to share a lot of that stuff with you. And Milo Yiannopoulos sings to a room full of Nazis. an interesting piece that came out in BuzzFeed that really details how close Breitbart is with literal neo-Nazis. So, you know, I always knew, I'm sure most of you guys knew they're a right-wing rag, but you'll see just how bad it is in a minute here. Okay, so let's get started, and we're going to do that with some corporate Democrats who are back at it again. Quite a video here for you, because it shows that the playbook from the 2016 primary really hasn't changed. Representative Joe Crowley is the fourth most powerful Democrat in the country. He's up there in leadership. And he went on MSNBC to discuss the fact that other prominent Democrats, in fact, the fifth in line Democrat, is critiquing Nancy Pelosi and critiquing Democratic leadership in general and saying, okay, it's time for you guys to step aside because we keep losing with you in power, and I think it's time for some fresh faces and a change. So Joe Crowley steps up to be his little, to play his servile establishment role, and let's see what he had to say.
The Democrats obviously want to retake the House, and if they can, the Senate as well in 2018. Nancy Pelosi is a lightning rod. The Republicans use her pretty effectively to rally support among their voters to get them to vote for. Republican lawmakers, are you concerned that she will be a liability for 2018 when Democrats could have a real opening to retake both houses of Congress, at least one of those?
You know, Katie, I've heard that argument used so many times before, and I think it really reflects the sexism that still exists in politics today. I think Nancy Pelosi is held to a different standard than others are. The vilification of her in a very sexist way, quite frankly, is what's led to this discussion. What I think Nancy Pelosi, as I said before, is one of the smartest and hardest working members of our caucus. And what we need to be doing right now as a caucus is focusing on the issues that will advance the cause of the American people. And I think it will also lead the American people to believe and understand that Democrats should be in control of the House of Representatives.
There it is. It's back. McFeminism, ladies and gentlemen. You know, that's the feminism that's as real as the meat and the chicken nuggets. All she says is, hey, look, Nancy Pelosi, she's used as a punching bag by Republicans who are running, and it works. They go, yeah, we despise Nancy Pelosi. She's the kind of limousine liberal who's out of touch with the working class, and it comically so, has been in leadership for a long time. There's been over 1,000 losses under her leadership and under Barack Obama as president. And so you have Katie Turr saying, hey, she's a liability. So, you know, that's just a fact. Like, okay, you haven't done well under her. She's a liability. And what's his response? That's sexist. What is sexist? What part of that is sexist? There's no part of that that's sexist. You have no rebuttal, so you short circuit and go, sexism. This is exactly like the primary when people would say, hey man, I'm not sure I'm on board with Hillary. She voted for the Iraq War. She voted for the Patriot Act. She orchestrated intervention in Libya. She's for intervention in Syria. She was okay with NAFTA and outsourcing jobs, okay with Wall Street deregulation. There's a lot of questionable stuff in her record, so I'm not sure I'm on board with it. And the rebuttal was what? Sexism. Or my favorite one is when people said, hey, she's really close with Wall Street. I mean, look at the amount of money that she's taking from Wall Street. She gave 2 speeches and got over $600,000. I'm concerned about that. He went, oh, so when a woman takes money from Wall Street, then it's a problem? No, the same people who were complaining about Hillary taking money from Wall Street are the same people who were complaining about it when it was Barack Obama and every other candidate, whether on the right or the left. So it's just, it's a deflection, it's obfuscation, and it's smearing you because there's no rational, coherent response. And the problem with Nancy Pelosi is that she's a proven loser, and she's an out-of-touch corporate Democrat. So at a time when more and more people in the party, it was about 72, now it's over 118, all these people are coming out in support of Medicare for All. And that has a lot to do with you guys, Justice Democrats, Brand New Congress, National Nurses United, everybody on the populist left, Our Revolution, the Fight for 15, pushing members of Congress, hey, do this or else. Nancy Pelosi is still steadfast in her opposition to Medicare for All. By the way, a policy that over 80% of Democrats support, over 60% of the country supports it, over 80% of Democrats support it, and one of the leaders in the Democratic Party is like, I don't know, I'm not sure the American people are there yet. That's what she said. She said, I'm not sure the American people are there yet. Well, maybe you should read a goddamn poll. Maybe you should do that. But the reality is, it's not that, you know, hey, she has an ideological or philosophical disagreement with single payer. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with the fact that she's beholden to the donors. And she even admitted it. She said, look, you guys can't get rid of me as a leader. I'm a great fundraiser. That's what she said. And then she said, unfortunately, that's the system we have. So in other words, deep down she knows, hey, you know, these big donors and these corporations and these billionaires, they really affect politics and affect politicians and the direction that we go in. But yeah, that's the system we have, and I'm great at that system. I'm one of the best fundraisers. And it's unfortunate, but it is what it is. So that's an admission right there. Sure, I sell out the most to big donors, so I raise a lot of money, but hey, you can't get rid of me because that's important. Well, what if I told you, Nancy, it's not important? What if I told you, this is, a very Hillary Clinton-esque argument of, well, it just is what it is and we can't change it, so in the context of this system, I'm great. But the system is cancerous. The system is the problem. You have to reform the system and be bold enough to even want to try, but you don't even want to try. You want to say, well, I'm good at playing the game as it exists. But that's the fucking problem, is that you're good at playing the game as it exists. So you raise more money from big donors and you do their bidding more, which is why you're not in favor of single payer. So, I mean, these guys, man, I got good news for you, though. And this is, like, we can all breathe a sigh of relief here. That guy who you just heard use classic McFeminism, which, by the way, is grotesque and disgusting, not only because it's wrong, but also because it cheapens actual issues of sexism. Because it's boy who cried wolf all day long. You know, oh, it's so sexist, but that's not sexist. And then when something actually sexist happens, you've now made regular people roll their eyes and go, here we go again. You're going to say that's sexist. But guess what? Joe Crowley, the Democratic leader who you just heard use McFeminism there and dodge important issues, Justice Democrats are primarying him. It was one of our earlier candidates that we announced. So Alex Ocasio-Cortez is running against corrupt Joe Crowley. Joe Crowley, by the way, is a guy, not only does he just use McFeminism, he also dipped out of a congressional debate on regulating Wall Street to go raise money from Wall Street. Wow. I mean, that is so brazen. But that's the thing. He got so comfortable. Oh, it's so comfy up here in Democratic leadership, taking big money. Oh, this is so great. Oh, did you critique Nancy Pelosi for corruption and for being a terrible politician? You must be sexist. Well, Joe, as long as we're using McFeminism here, why are you still in the race if Alex Ocasio-Cortez is running? You do realize she's a woman, right? And you're going to stay in the race against a woman? Well, I guess you must be sexist. It's so sexist of Joe Crowley to say, hey, here's a woman and a woman of color, Joe, who says, you know, maybe it's time for you to step aside and maybe it's time for new leadership. Female voices, voices from minorities. What happened, Joe? By your own standard of invoking sexism when there's even a mild critique of a woman for legitimate reason, by your own standard, this is definitely sexism. So please spare me your garbage arguments. And the reality is, it's not that you should support Alex Ocasio-Cortez simply because she's a woman or a person of color. You should support her because she supports Medicare for all. She supports free college. She supports a living wage. She supports getting money out of politics. She's taking no corporate money and no PAC money. So she's raising money only from you, regular people. And that's the way to guarantee that these politicians don't lose track of why they're running in the first place. Nice random noise from the computer. But that's the only way to guarantee that happens, is you build it into the incentive structure. And the reality is, if our politicians for Justice Democrats only raise money from regular people, take no corporate money and no PAC money, they're going to represent regular people, which is why we need you. If you're sick of this McFeminism garbage and you're sick of Joe Crowley hiding behind stuff like this to keep pushing a corrupt agenda, go to justicedemocrats.com/fight. Let's get Alex Ocasio-Cortez in there. Guys, nobody's going to help us. The media is not going to help us. She didn't even push back Katie Turr when Joe Crowley was like, meh, sexism, because Nancy Pelosi doesn't believe in single payer and is massively corrupt and cozy with Wall Street and has a losing record. But it's sexism to bring that up. The journalist didn't even say, well, that's ridiculous. Didn't happen. So they're letting Joe Crowley go on all the major media outlets and spew bullshit all day long. So the only ones who are going to save us is us. Is us, are us. The only ones who are going to save us are us, is us. Whatever. You get what the fuck I'm saying. So go to justicedemocrats.com/fight. Make your donation. We have 16 Justice Democrats who are running, and we're trying to do as much as possible, man. Trying to do as much as possible, run as many candidates as possible. We want to win every single race that we're in. One of our biggest races, though, is against this jackass, corrupt Joe Crowley. And we have, that's one of our biggest races. Joe Manchin, Paula Jean Swearingen running against Joe Manchin, one of our biggest races. Let's get people who are populist left elected and get rid of clowns like this. Okay. Now, let's discuss the NRA. Waka waka, bitch. Here's a headline that you don't see often. NRA calls for more regulation after Vegas shooting. What? I don't understand. What I I'm at a loss. I don't know how that happened. Goodness gracious. Okay, well, let me give you the specifics. The National Rifle Association said on Thursday, devices that allow semi-automatic rifles to function like fully automatic ones need tougher regulation. And it called on regulators to determine whether the bump stock devices comply with federal law. The National Rifle Association is calling on the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives to immediately review whether these devices comply with federal law. The powerful gun lobby said in a statement, the NRA believes that devices designed to allow semi-automatic rifles to function like fully automatic rifles should be subject to additional regulations, it said. Okay, so first things first, good. Good. I'm happy that they said this. But here's the curious part of this, and I haven't seen anybody bring this up, certainly not in the mainstream media. If the NRA is willing to concede this, how did they not just undercut the argument that they make after every mass shooting when they don't call for more regulation? So what they say is, look, man, of course we sympathize with the victims. Who doesn't sympathize with the victims? It's horrendous. But the way to stop this is for everybody to be armed, because the only way you stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. And if there's a bad guy with a gun doing bad things, well, then you just need a good guy with a gun there to stop him. So by this logic, everybody should be armed, because there's more good people than bad people. And what, do you want the good people to be outmatched with their firepower? Whatever guns the bad people have, the good people should have. And if you ban these devices, well, then only law-abiding citizens are going to listen to you. Only law-abiding citizens are going to not use these devices anymore. So now you've made it so that criminals still have these devices that make semi-automatic weapons fully automatic weapons, and now you've made it so regular people who abide by the law are sitting ducks. What, wouldn't you want good people to have the same firepower as the bad people? So why would you pass a law that criminals aren't going to follow anyway and make it so that criminals are the ones who have fully automatic weapons and good people do not? This is the argument they make. They make these arguments. Only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. There's more good people than bad people, so if you arm everybody, then a bad person starts shooting people up, and there's a good guy with a gun there to stop the bad person. You just undercut every argument you made in that front. Seriously, you hear from gun advocates, especially when it comes to the government. They go, any gun the government have is something we should have, because the whole idea is to stop tyranny. So we need to have the firepower to overthrow the government if need be. That's the whole point of the Second Amendment. So we have to have everything that the government has. It should be legal for us to have any kind of firepower the government has. Well, okay, by that logic, you should be able to have, you know, anti-aircraft guns and missiles. You should be able to have chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, you know. So I'm happy they did this, but they have to understand they just undercut their entire argument, because their argument was, hey, any regulation is a bad idea, because then you're handicapping the good people. But, by the way, they're so right to undercut that argument, because it's ridiculous. To make the point that, hey, if you pass a law, only law-abiding citizens are going to follow it, and the criminals aren't going to follow it, so why pass the law in the first place? Well, apply that logic to any law. Here you are with your fancy schmancy anti-murder laws, but obviously only good people are going to follow it, so the bad people aren't going to stop murdering, so why pass the law in the first place? What? Nobody would make that argument, because it sounds ridiculous. But then why do people make that argument when it comes to guns? Like, oh, you want to ban, like, fully automatic weapons? Well, only the criminals are only the good people are going to follow it. The criminals are still going to use them. So why pass the law? Well, you pass the law because people shouldn't have, you know, fully automatic weapons. And even if it doesn't stop every single person from having, every single bad guy from getting a fully automatic weapon, it'll stop some. It'll stop many. And this is the point, man. When you look at statistics as opposed to anecdotal cases, that's the last refuge of the full-on gun supporter, the gun anarchist, if you will. They go, well, come on, the situation in Las Vegas wouldn't have been prevented because some of the guns he had were illegal. So if some of the guns he had were illegal, it's not like making guns more illegal or something would have fixed the problem. Well, guess what? That's correct. If you have somebody like that and they break the law anyway, well, in that particular instance, yes, maybe it wouldn't have been able to be prevented. Maybe it wouldn't have. But on the flip side, if you had efficient, reasonable gun legislation, at the end of the year, would we really have 33,000 deaths due to guns? The answer is no. Now, how do I know that? Because you look at the countries that have the laws we're describing, and they have like 100 gun deaths or less. So in other words, yes, it's not foolproof. Some of the criminals are going to get the guns anyway and do the crimes. That's a guarantee. But you're going to cut the number of people that are able to do that tremendously. So you're, even if it's in the U.S., let's say it's a 50% cut in homicides. Right now we have about, what, 11,000 homicides per year with guns. Other modern nations have like 100 or less, okay? So if we have some reasonable gun legislation here, let's say you take that 11,000 number and you make it 5,500 homicides per year. You can save 5,500 lives! So there's a point to be made about statistics and about how you deter some people. You make it more difficult to get a gun, and some people might not be able to get those particular kinds of guns. Some will, which is why you can't say, hey, this would dissuade this particular shooter, but it would deter many, and it would stop many, and that's the whole point of looking at macro statistics as opposed to obsessing over anecdotal individual cases, which they think makes the ironclad argument, but of course it doesn't. So, I don't know, am I being clear enough about this? And let me go on the record for the 9,000th time. I'm not in favor of banning guns. I'm not. And, you know, maybe some people in my audience would be mad at me for not being in favor of something like that. But my view on guns is the same as my view on drugs, which is legal, taxed, and regulated. So, in other words, if you're a law-abiding citizen and you want to have a gun, by all means, you know, if there's nothing in your background, by all means, go right ahead. But they should be regulated. You shouldn't be able to get any kind of gun. You shouldn't be able to get any kind of device to attach to it, like in this case, to make a semi-automatic, a fully automatic. You shouldn't – I mean, that should be obvious that if you're in favor – I mean, think about it in an international sense. If you're somebody on the right and you say, well, of course I don't want North Korea getting a nuke or I don't want Iran getting a nuke or something, okay, well, you just bought into the logic of gun control. Because what you're saying is, yeah, there are some people who I think are irrational actors who wouldn't be able to handle that. Well, then why wouldn't it be the same for here at home? When there's that guy's a paranoid schizophrenic, that guy's a psychopath, that guy's a jihadist, that guy's a neo-Nazi. Why wouldn't it be, hey, man, we should try to do what we can within reason to allow good people to have guns but take certain guns away from bad people and, you know, try to craft laws that are nuanced, that are reasonable in that there's a registration process and there's a permit process and there's maybe a class or something and you can't have high-capacity magazines and you can't have certain kinds of weapons, certain kinds of devices to add on to the weapons. It's not a lot to ask for mild regulation like universal background checks and high-capacity magazine bans. So, yes, that's the answer. And the NRA just bought into that logic right here. The logic of, well, of course some regulations make sense. I am a free speech absolutist. The First Amendment, freedom of speech. But that doesn't mean you get to make direct threats of violence to somebody. That's still decidedly against the law, and the Supreme Court has approved that. And the Supreme Court has said, yes, of course, we believe in free speech, but you can't make direct threats of violence against people. Of course you can't. You know, you can't do libel, you can't do slander. So we have free speech, and we're very free in that respect, but there are some lines and regulations. Well, same with guns. So they've just bought into that logic. The NRA just bought into that logic. that, yes, there's some things he... Okay, well, thank you. So then now, at least let's be intellectually honest, and let's say the discussion is, where do we draw the line? So it's a disingenuous argument to say, there is no line, because we know that's not true. You don't believe regular people should be able to have nuclear weapons or biological weapons or chemical weapons or anti-aircraft guns or whatever, RPGs. So you agree there is a line, then the question becomes, where is the line? Enough with this disingenuous bullshit of, no, my position is there is no line. Well, that's what the NRA said all this time, and now they said, no, okay, there is a line, but it's just a matter of where is it. Great, so let's have that conversation. And guess what? My side's going to win in that conversation. Why? Because of the polls. Over 90% say universal background check. Over 50% say ban on high-capacity magazines. Majority of Democrats, independents, and Republicans agree to those forms of gun control. Even most NRA members agree to that. But the leadership usually doesn't agree to that because they take money from the gun manufacturers who want no rules. Well, guess what? It turns out that whatever this add-on device is that turns a semi-automatic into a fully automatic, looks like they didn't pay their bribe to the NRA. Because if they did pay their bribe to the NRA, you bet your bottom dollar they'd be out there saying, oh, we can't regulate these. No, these we still need to allow because, you know, you want to take away this device from the good guys only? Because only the good guys are going to follow the law. The bad guys are still going to have these devices, so why ban them? That's the way the system works. The NRA leadership does the bidding of the gun manufacturers. Apparently, the people who make this product, which turns a semi-automatic into a fully automatic, didn't pay their bribes. Okay. All right, let me take my first break. When we come back, United States rejects a UN resolution, and Donald Trump makes incredibly, incredibly cryptic comments. Don't miss it. Stay right there. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
myself, the left. Please don't make me snap you with the left, the left. I will take so I'm gonna grab you with the left, the left. I feel like I'm the left, renegade left, the left. It's like I'm on an island by myself, the left.
Son of a bitch. I like how every day I kick off the show, I'm supposed to do like three or four stories in the first segment. It's like a guarantee I always do two in the first block. Sad. That's really sad. And by the way, it's almost mid-October and it's 80 degrees in New York. Yeah, that's not cool. I used to think I didn't like the change of seasons, but now I feel like I like it because, I don't know, the 80 to 90 degree weather, like after a while it just gets fucking taxing. And you're like, can a brother get 55 or 60? Just give me a 60, even a 65, please. Hit us with the air conditioner. But no. Okay, so let's continue here. Wait until you get a load of this story. So there's a wild story that's not getting nearly enough attention. I mean, online it made quite a splash, but CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, NBC, CBS, ABC, the nightly news, barely a peep, barely a mention, which is pathetic. And by the way, it kind of feeds into Noam Chomsky's thesis in Manufacturing Consent in terms of the corporate structure of media sometimes serves state power even more than state media serves state power. So you'll see what I mean here in a second. What story am I talking about? United States rejects UN resolution condemning use of death penalty to target LGBTQ people. Wow. So the resolution was against the death penalty, and it was also specifically against the death penalty for apostasy, blasphemy, adultery, and consensual same-sex relations. The U.S. voted against it and also demanded that executions be allowed with experimental drugs, and the vote was 27 to 13. I'm sure, as you can imagine, all the modern countries were for this resolution, and the U.S., you know, was lumped in with fucking theocracies and backwards-ass dictatorships. So this is probably one of the biggest stories of the week. It should be. People should be like, what the fuck just happened here? But again, it's really not getting that much coverage, certainly not in the mainstream media, because what's the only logical takeaway from this story? Oh, the U.S. is massively full of shit when they talk about where the world police, you know, where the people who uphold civil liberties, human rights, around the world, where the people who care about altruism and justice and freedom and democracy, which is why we're best friends with Saudi Arabia, an absolute monarchy and a theocracy, why we're friends with the perpetual occupiers in Israel. So this just busts up that whole, I mean, those alliances alone bust up that whole mythology. You can't say you care deeply about human rights and then, you know, give smooth hand jobs to the Saudi king and hold hands with him as you walk through the garden. You don't get to do that. You don't get to say, oh, man, we love freedom. And by the way, Saudi Arabia, one of the most oppressive countries on earth, we're not even going to criticize them. We're going to make love to them. So you don't get to say that up front. But, I mean, look at how brazen this is, because this is an example of you don't even have to, like, directly snub your oil butt buddy ally, Saudi Arabia. This is just like, you know, a non-binding, like, hey, man, here's what we think about this issue. And the U.S. couldn't bring itself to say, yes, the death penalty, and specifically the death penalty against apostasy, blasphemy, adultery, and consensual same-sex relations, it's wrong. human rights, liberal values. The U.S. spreads liberal democratic values, except when it doesn't, and it spreads far-right dictatorial theocratic values. I mean, how easy should it be to say, you know what, if somebody says, I want to leave Islam, or I want to leave religion, they shouldn't be killed. Is that hard to do? Is it hard to say, hey, if you make fun of somebody's God, you shouldn't be killed? I know, in elite circles, it's impolite to slam somebody's religion. But should you be killed if you do it? Should you be killed if you have consensual same-sex relations? Should you be killed if somebody cheats on their spouse? Killed. You know, I feel like the younger generations see stories like this and they go, oh, so we see how full of shit our government is and how it's all about natural resources and the status quo and remaining the sole imperial power. And the younger people see this and they go, that is complete and utter horse shit, and now we're going to fight to try to make our country better. But unfortunately, the reality is a lot of people in older generations either don't see this stuff, or when they do see it, they just kind of shrug it off.
Necessary alliances. Sure, we go back on everything we claim to believe in, but that's only because it's a necessary alliance. You know, what are we going to do? We have to say that killing people for consensual same-sex relations is okay, right? Hoo-hoo-hoo!
Well, then just don't pretend you're the world police and you care about human rights and civil liberties, because you decidedly do not. It's the exact opposite. You don't give a fuck about them when they conflict with your business relationships. Business overrides everything. Power overrides everything. And you'll look the other way to the most heinous crimes. So spare me your fucking moralizing about how, oh my goodness, we have to get involved in this country or that country because it's a humanitarian crisis. You don't give a fuck about that, because if you did, you would have clearly voted for this resolution. But not only that, you would have been working behind the scenes diplomatically to try to stop all the human rights abusers who are your allies and stop your own human rights abuses. Guantanamo Bay is still open. You know, we torture people. We do wars of aggression. We're bombing seven nations right now. Don't tell me you care about human rights and justice. It's so disingenuous and it's pathetic. All right, now let's go to Donald Trump's comments. Donald Trump made some really cryptic, ominous comments yesterday while he was meeting with top military brass. Let's take a look at the video.
You guys know what this represents?
Tell us, sir.
Maybe it's the calm before the storm. Like the storm could be the calm before the storm. We have the world's great military people in this room, I will tell you that. And we're going to have a great evening. Thank you all for coming.
What storm is this?
You'll find out. Give us a hint of your hand. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much.
We're so fucked. We're so fucked. There's no way that whatever he's talking about is going to be acceptable. I mean, he's in a room with top military officials, and he's saying this represents the calm before the storm. And they ask, what storm? You'll find out. Oh. Oh, no. Oh, no. I mean, what are you going to do? Are you going to escalate Afghanistan further? Escalate Iraq further? Maybe put more boots on the ground in Syria? Is that what you're going to do? But the real concern, there's two of them. One of them's Iran. We'll get to that in a little bit, because there was he was announced the other day that they're going to decertify the nuclear deal. We'll do a separate story on that. But and probably the main concern, though, is North Korea. I mean, that's what I think that's in reference to. It's either Iran or North Korea. Something's coming. Something's coming, and it's going to be big. You get the feeling that that's one of those clips that's going to be played for years and years and years to come. And it's going to be just the perfect little nugget, the perfect little encapsulation of the moral decay of the United States. We've been, post-World War II, I mean, we've been horrendous. I mean, we've done wars of aggression across the board to spread our own ideology, to enrich our own corporations. Vietnam, I mean, think of Iraq, look at what everything we've done. But this is, we're at the point now where they just wear it on their fucking sleeve, man. You know, even with Bush and Cheney, though they're war criminals, clearly, they at least had the wherewithal to try to pretend that we're not, it's not that we're doing wars of aggression. They were, of course, but they act, no. Saddam had weapons of mass destruction and, you know, he did 9/11 or something and he was maybe going to attack us. Because they knew, hey, look, in the history books, we have to have plausible deniability. We can't make it look like we were the monsters who just did an offensive war. But Trump's at the point where, does that clip look like he's concerned that we're going to get attacked by Iran or North Korea? Or does it look like he's maniacally planning an offensive war against them? I think I know how history is going to judge that one. Because that's exactly what it looks like. Because that's probably what it is. The calm before the storm. And then what? Are you going to try to come to us in a few weeks and say, oh, no, North Korea was going to attack us, so we had to attack them? Please, man. That man who has the attention span of a gnat and is more thin-skinned than the thinniest thin-skinned thin skinner. That made no sense, but you get the point. He's in control of our nuclear arsenal, and he's the commander-in-chief. And if at a point he doesn't want to get reeled in by anybody around him, General Kelly, Mattis, or anybody else, then he's not going to get reeled in. And they've been Kim Jong-un and him have been jawing back and forth for months now. And it could all come to a head here. I don't know exactly what the fuck they're referring to, but it can't be good. You don't say this is a calm before the storm in a room full of top military officials without having something horrendous in mind. And, of course, they'll spin it to themselves, you know, in their own minds. Oh, no, we're the good guys, even if we wage offensive wars, even if we are responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. I don't know what you mean. We mean well or something. Oh, no. Again, that's the issue that keeps me up at night. People ask this in the Q&A. That's the issue. There are bigger ones, systematic ones, money and politics, climate change, that need to be addressed, obviously. The one that's the most immediate threat, this jackass being in control of our military and the unstable situation with North Korea. People just have this false impression that because we're not at war now, like, it's not going to ever happen. That's not comforting, because it can change in an instant. It might not feel like it, but it can. Okay. Scary times. Very scary times. Okay, next. Lighten it up a little bit here. Paul Joseph Watson is a guy who is an affiliate in Alex Jones' network InfoWars. My understanding is that he has, you know, a similar thing going on with Alex Jones that I have going on with TYT. I'm an affiliate in their network. He's an affiliate in Alex Jones' InfoWars network. His YouTube channel is Prison Planet, which is actually a very successful channel. He has very impressive numbers on that channel, a lot of views, a lot of subscribers. And Paul somewhat regularly goes on Alex Jones' show, and in the wake of the Vegas shooting, he did exactly that. And watch him struggle to deal with Alex Jones' craziness live on air. This brought a smile to my face. Look.
Could turn out to be, it wasn't left wing, it wasn't right wing, it wasn't an Islamic terrorist, it was just a mindless act of evil. It does happen sometimes where you just get mentally deranged people who are hopped up on whatever SSRI drugs. You know, the Batman shooter, he claimed he was motivated by a movie
let me stop
and he
you.
Wanted to become the Joker.
Let
so
me stop you. We've got,
we've got
breaking news here, Paul Watson, that's absolutely critical, absolutely key. I have gotten this. No cameras, please, guys. No cameras. This is from a law enforcement source. And the information is the news is lying. FBI HRT did the hit on the guy. And they found Antifa information in the room and photos of the woman in the Middle East. So he did not kill himself. The FBI hostage rescue team killed him because he was firing on them. So he did not want to be taken alive, and reportedly he did it. And it was Antifa crap everywhere. And other things I'm not supposed to mention. That is directly from the hostage rescue team, by the way, Paul. And I'm going to delete this information now. Keep going.
Well, obviously, that's huge. That's huge if it turns out to be true.
Yeah, hey, Paul. Paul, this is from high-level CIA. Right here. Went through directly from... And this is from a hostage rescue team. You know I don't make sources up.
No, all I'm saying is that I'm going on the information I have, and I don't know.
No, absolutely, absolutely. I'm just saying this is big breaking news. This is huge. In fact, you go ahead and take over the next 4 minutes. You host. I'm going to run in here and get with the writers. Go.
All right.
Oh, I love every second of that. Paul Joseph Watson's one of these guys who's like, dude, come on, stop it. I just want to make videos about how social justice warriors suck and how I hate immigrants. Can we stop with the... Fuck, here we go again. Paul Joseph Watson is... I don't know the extent of his conspiracy theory beliefs, but if he has them, it's nowhere near what Alex Jones... conspiracy beliefs are. Alex Jones thinks Sandy Hook was a fucking hoax. Paul Joseph Watson does not. And that's the first thing that people bring up when they talk to Paul Joseph Watson. And he's like, no, I don't believe that. And it's almost like he's like, fuck, what have I gotten myself into here? And then this is another one where Alex Jones is like fucking going off the rails like, it's Antifa. It's anti-fascist. But wait a second, the day after the shooting, pause, let that marinate in your brain how preposterous it is that Alex Jones thought he had it figured out not even 24 hours after the shooting, not even the day after. So he said it was the Bolsheviks. So it's the Bolsheviks, but it's Antifa, but it's also ISIS backed by deep state Democrats, is another claim he made. Look at all the – just throw mud against the wall, hope it sticks. It's everybody I don't like. It's the Bolsheviks, it's Antifa, it's ISIS, it's deep state Democrats. What? Because he just makes it up. He just makes it. Again, investigators couldn't even tell you exactly what's going on within 24 hours of the shooting. Alex Jones was on his show going, this has all the markings of ISIS and their deep state Democratic allies. Have some fucking decency, dude. Everybody knows you don't know what the fuck happened, but everything is a conspiracy immediately after. And then notice, hilarious trick from Alex Jones. Whenever it's a Democrat, whenever it's Obama in office, not only is it a conspiracy, but it's a conspiracy that goes to Obama. So it all stops in the Oval Office. But that's only when he dislikes the person who's president. When he likes the person like Trump, now it's a conspiracy. But no, Trump isn't responsible. Of course, Trump's not responsible, even though last time there was a conspiracy. It somehow went to the Oval Office. Now it doesn't go to the Oval Office. Now it's below Trump, and Trump doesn't know what's going on, and Trump's just an innocent guy trying to fix everything, trying to make America great again. Look, this guy's – he's been saying the same shit since the late 90s, and it hasn't come to pass. Where are the black helicopters? Where are the FEMA camps? We were all supposed to be in FEMA camps before Obama left office. He was supposed to ban golf courses and ban gasoline, and, you know, we're supposed to be swooped up by black helicopters. It didn't happen. You said that Sandy Hook was to come and take everybody's guns. Not only did they not take everybody's guns, they didn't propose it. They didn't even get a fucking mild, watered-down background check bill through. So your whole motive was wrong. You made up what you thought was happening. Hey, they're doing this to take the guns. But, Alex, they didn't take the guns. Okay, but they did. They faked it anyway? And now in this, less than 24 hours after, I got to figure it out. It's ISIS, it's the Bolsheviks, it's the deep state Democrats, and it's Antifa. Right, can you imagine? Yeah, there was Antifa stuff all over his room, sure. They walked in. And what does that even mean, Antifa stuff? What is there, a picture of the fucking poster of Antifa on the wall or somebody? Walks in, he's like, I know this is a hotel room, I've only been here for less than a week, but here, I put up posters of fucking Antifa. What the fuck are you talking about? He's such a baby. He just makes shit up. And Paul Joseph Watson knows that. He knows it. He knows it. He knows it. So he's listening, and he's like, please stop. Please stop, Alex. And Alex keeps going, and he's like, okay. It looks like he's fucking beaten down by Alex's waterfall of bullshit, just a tsunami of bullshit from all the years. So, hey, now I know why he calls his channel Prison Planet. It looks like he's in his own personal prison. Okay. All right, let's squeeze in one more before we take our final break. Pew Research Center is out with some new numbers for us about how Americans feel in regards to the economy. There are many lessons to take away from this, and actually this Pew poll gets into a bunch of stuff. It gets into the economy, it gets into religion, and we're going to do some separate segments here focusing on various parts of this. But listen to this. 65% of Americans say the system unfairly favors powerful interests. Just 32% say the system is fair to most Americans. 65% unfavorably favors. That makes no sense. Unfairly favors powerful interests. So that means most Democrats, most independents, and maybe even a majority of Republicans go, yeah, of course, this thing is rigged, and it's the corporations and the elites that are controlling everything. Okay, but that's just a little appetizer for you. Here's the most unbelievable fact. It says here, race, education, and income differences in views on economic inequality. So this is the percentage who say economic inequality in the U.S. is a blank problem. So let's go to the total number first. 48% say it's a very big problem. 48% of Americans say economic inequality is a very big problem. And 34% say it's a moderately. That means 82% of Americans, 82%, a stunning majority, say economic inequality is a big problem. That's Democrats, that's independents, that's Republicans. In fact, if you go through that list and you do the math on it, whether you talk about white people, black people, Hispanic, post-grad, college grad, some college, high school or less, and even when you go by income, guess what? Everybody says economic inequality is a big problem. When you add up the column for very big and moderately big, even for Republicans, look at that, even for Republicans and lean Republicans. So 26% say economic inequality is a very big problem, and 43% say moderately big. So add that up, 40, 50, 60, 6. Wait, did I fuck that up? 4, 5, 6. No, I didn't. So that's 69% of Republicans say economic inequality is a big problem. You know, it's almost like if the Democrats unapologetically ran on fighting income inequality. Hey, let's tax the rich. Hey, let's do card check and get stronger unions. Let's have a living wage. Let's raise corporate taxes. It's almost like if the Democrats ran on a platform that said, yes, I'm in favor of taxing the rich. Yes, I'm in favor of strong unions. Yes, I'm in favor of a living wage, that they would win. It's almost like if you stand up for regular people, you win. It's almost like class politics that recognizes that it's the rich waging class war on us, and we're just sitting here like sitting ducks and taking it. It's almost like if you say, no, I'm going to fight back because they started it, you'll win. But no, of course, what we get is, as we discussed on the story the other day, Joe Biden going to Alabama, campaigning for a Democratic Senate hopeful, saying, you know, the rich are patriots too. I know Bernie doesn't like me saying that, but I'm going to say it because I'm here in Alabama and I think we need to move to the right to succeed. No, you idiot, you're doing the exact wrong strategy. What if you ran populist left? If you run populist left, not only do Democrats like it, but independents like it, and even Republicans like it. You don't defeat Republicans by being Republican light. You defeat Republicans by being populist left. And this is more evidence of it right here. Okay. All right, so we'll take our final break. When we come back, Democratic voters are becoming more interventionist. What? That was a weird story. And then we got Milo Yiannopoulos. And we'll get back to that Pew poll and discuss. That's an interesting story, man. We'll discuss views on God. So stay right there. We will be right back.
rock you with the left, the left. You will think so, I'm gonna rock you with the left, the left. I feel like I'm the left, real nigga left, the left. It's like I'm on an island by myself, the left. Please don't make me slap you with the left, the left. You will think so, I'm gonna rock you with the left, the left. I feel like I'm the left, real nigga left, the left. It's like I'm
son of a bitch. Okay. All right, we are back, and actually, let's do the Iran story real quick. So yesterday, scrolling through Twitter, and boom, this hits me. Breaking, Trump plans to announce next week that he will decertify the Iran nuclear deal. Yeah, as far as Obama's accomplishments go, everybody knows who listens to this show on a regular basis that I think he's a massive, massive mixed bag. He did good things, he did bad things, and I did a whole segment, go check it out if you haven't yet. It basically breaks down, I break down his entire presidency and give him like a report card, give him a grade. So check that out if you haven't. But this is one of his biggest accomplishments. Basically, what the Iran deal does is it makes it so that Iran doesn't get a nuke. And in return for the guarantee that they don't get nuclear weapons, and by the way we verify that is the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, regularly checks in, and they have to report back, and they have to keep their enrichment below certain levels so that they only use it for research and for power for their power grid. But basically what happens is if they agree to not enrich past a certain point, in return, we relieve economic sanctions on them. So we lift the economic sanctions, that revitalizes their economy, that makes them wealthier, they can create more jobs, and the idea is, hey, if we can get on a better footing, if Iran and the U.S. can get on a better footing, then maybe in the future there's some sort of economic deal and, you know, we can move away from the brink of war, because you know what the rhetoric is like. We like to say Iran's the number one state sponsor of terrorism, which, by the way, is hilariously stupid and totally wrong. Saudi Arabia is the number one state sponsor of terrorism. But the idea is, okay, you guys don't get a nuke. In return, we lift sanctions. And basically the only way to violate the nuclear deal is if we put sanctions back on them. Guess what? Not only did we do that, we did it multiple times. We did it multiple times. We're supposed to, okay, like the right-wingers have this shitty talking point. They're like, you gave billions to Iran. What they don't tell you is us giving Iran back their own money that we stole from them. So they don't tell you that's their money. We just stole it from them. Now we're giving it back as part of the deal. Hey, you let the IAEA in, we make sure you don't get nuclear weapons, and you can have your own money back, and we lift sanctions. So Congress decided, hey, we're going to vote for more sanctions on them. Of course, Trump has been talking shit, not just with North Korea, but with Iran for a while now. And usually, Iran always responds in kind. So whatever the U.S. does, they'll do something similar. So if we violate the nuclear deal, they'll turn around and violate the nuclear deal with like a missile test or something. And of course, what does the U.S. media do? They never give you context. They never give you perspective. They never say, hey, the reason Iran did that is because the U.S. violated the nuclear deal first. But, you know, Trump's in a room full of deep state neocons, and they've always wanted regime change in Iran. They've always wanted war. They've been pushing for it ever since Bush and Cheney were in office. So now it looks like they're going to move even closer to that because, I mean, think about how disrespectful that is. We do all this work. We get this nuclear deal, and then we violate it repeatedly. And then now Trump's saying we're going to pull out of it. This is the same thing, like, with the fucking pulling out of the Paris Agreement. It's... what do you want? The answer is he doesn't know. He's empty. He's a vessel for the wishes of deep state neocons. And He doesn't care that this destabilizes the region even further. He doesn't care that this makes it more likely that Iran will get a nuke. Not less likely, makes it more likely that Iran will get a nuke. So this thing that he claims he cares most about is the thing that he's bringing into reality. They're more likely to get a nuke if he pulls out of it. So it looks like, yet again, he can't help himself, pushing to the brink of war with North Korea. He'll want to push to the brink of war with Iran. And make no mistake about it, if indeed we get to that point, it will be because the U.S. is the aggressor. And here you have Trump doing the bidding of deep state neocons and Israel and Netanyahu. Their number one enemy in their mind is Iran. In fact, literally to the point where they would support jihadist proxies against them. In fact, you have Israel has treated jihadists who are fighting the Syrian government. Think about that. They're so against the Syrian government and the Iranian government that they're willing to de facto align themselves with jihadists. That's taken a page out of the U.S.'s book, too, because we've, of course, armed, funded jihadists for decades now. But this is where we're at. Getting out of the Iran nuclear deal, which is one of Obama's best accomplishments, if not his best accomplishment. So buckle up, because this wild ride, this bumpy ride, is about to get even bumpier. Okay. BuzzFeed News released a long article about Breitbart yesterday, and they managed to get their hands on internal emails that have some pretty damning stuff, so we're going to go through some of it here. One of the things that they released, I want to have some fun with this first, is this video of right-wing sensation Milo Yiannopoulos singing America the Beautiful to a bunch of neo-Nazis making the Nazi salute, including Richard Spencer, by the way. Let's watch. I got to give him some props on the singing. That wasn't bad, Milo. Milo? How do you say it? I think it's Milo, right? but, yeah, you saw, like, 3, 4, maybe 5 people in the audience were doing the Nazi salute. He was like, oh, I didn't see him. Really? And one of them was Richard Spencer. Richard Spencer was in the audience. And they... You know, Richard Spencer, who's like certified alt-right, goes after what he calls the alt-light, who are the people that in his mind, they don't go far enough. People like Gavin McInnes and probably, I don't know if Milo's included in the alt-light group, but seemingly Milo. So there was supposed to be some sort of feud between them, but it looks like they're buddy-buddy and they're hanging out and they're having fun. And, you know, Richard Spencer's out there doing the Nazi salute. And also, I love the irony of that. Singing America the Beautiful, America the Beautiful, while they make Nazi salutes, which is weird because, you know, the U.S. and Britain and Russia kind of defeated the Nazis. So you're thinking America the Beautiful while you're, like, paying homage to their enemies. It's a little weird. And by the way, some people are like, yeah, they're kidding. I don't think they're kidding, and the reason I don't think they're kidding is we've seen countless, you know, Richard Spencer speeches, and, you know, he's the guy who said, hail our people, hail Trump, hail victory. That's taken directly from Nazi speeches, where they go, obviously, hail Hitler, but hail our people. He talked about the Lügenpresse, which is the lying press, which is a Nazi term referring to the press. And then at that Richard Spencer speech, everybody in the audience was doing the Nazi salute. It was just so many people were just like, yeah, we know what's happening here. This is like barely masked neo-Nazism. And for a while, they tried to hide it. And they're like, no, no, we're just, you know, online troll culture and stuff. And like, anyway, here's some Pepe the Frogs. And no, we're just fucking with people with like memes and stuff. And we're just trying to trigger the liberals. Yeah, trigger liberals. So stupid liberals triggered. But now it's literally at the point where, like, Milo's singing America the Beautiful, people in the audience are doing the Nazi salute, and then some people are like, yeah, well, you fell for the fucking Nazi salute. Oh, is a Nazi salute get you angry? Fucking triggered liberal. Like, what the fuck is next? Like, as you're shoving people into gas chambers, like, oh, yeah, liberals, you're, like, triggered by the fact that I'm shoving people in gas chambers. Stupid liberal. I triggered you. Oh, my genocide triggered you? Like, what the fuck? So, yeah, it looks like they're all buddy-buddy. You know, you got the alt-right, you got neo-Nazis, you got all these internet celebrities in a way. Not bashing that part specifically, because who are we kidding? But there are other revelations in the piece as well. Steve Bannon told Milo to be more extreme and provocative to get more media attention. So that was after Milo had given a speech on a college campus and Black Lives Matter protesters stormed the stage. Milo said, I was actually scared that I was like going to get punched or something. And so Steve Bannon was like, dude, who are you kidding? You need more of this. Be more provocative. Get more attention like this, because this is going to get the attention of more people in the press, and it's going to get more eyeballs on us. And they offered him, I love this fact, they offered him, Bannon told Milo, we'll get you the Mercer's private security. We're going to get you some private security. And the Mercers, for those of you who don't know, are a big billionaire Republican donor family. So think about that. These are guys who claim, Bannon, Milo, they claim, oh, we're so anti-establishment. Oh, yes, we're just fighting the Republican establishment. In bed with the Mercers, billionaire establishment Republican donors. Not only that, there was another story about how Milo and Bannon and the dude from Duck Dynasty met on a yacht in France to meet with billionaires about financing. That is the opposite of anti-establishment. You are literally in bed with the establishment because you probably slept on the yacht in France. So it seems it's like the whole thing is like a ruse. It's all kind of mucked up and organized, and it's the Republican establishment in bed with people who people thought were anti-establishment, but they're not, and they really have uncomfortably close ties to like literal neo-Nazis. And the further proof to me that I was like, oh, come on, that's it. We're done here. Not just the fact that Milo and Richard Spencer were hanging out in Buddy Buddy and people are doing the fucking Nazi salute as he's singing, but Milo and Breitbart literally worked with the lead guy, I think the editor, at the Daily Stormer. So the Daily Stormer, that's like the literal white supremacist, white nationalist Nazi that they wear it on their sleeve, and they don't play the coy game of like where they play footsie with them, and they're like, hee-hee-hee, we kind of agree with you on everything, but no, in theory, I'm against racism and anti-Semitism and stuff. No, the Daily Stormer's like, hey, here we are, we're the racists and the anti-Semites. And Milo, when he wrote a piece on the alt-right, he was emailing back and forth with the Daily Stormer guy and like, hey, man, tell me like what you'd like me to add to this and stuff. And he did this with multiple people who are like noted white supremacist neo-Nazi figures. So in other words, the idea that Breitbart was like, you know, oh, come on, we're not the home of those people. We're against those people. Not only are you not against them, you were in bed with them asking them for suggestions. So, and Bannon said recently in a different interview, he was like, yeah, those people are stupid, the white nationalists and stuff. But the reality is, behind the scenes, Bannon and Milo and the rest of them were working with white nationalists, white supremacists, and even literal neo-Nazis. When you're buddy-buddy with the editor of the Daily Stormer, there was a separate email where Milo was like, this guy's one of the most brilliant, most intelligent guys I've ever spoken to. We need to get him on our podcast. And the guy who was the one of the other top officials at Breitbart was like, I don't know, man. I think that might be a little too far. So as they were making best friends with these overt white supremacists, other people at Breitbart were like, really? We're going to go that blatant with this, that overt with this, that in your face with this? But I saved the best for last. Here's my favorite part. Quote, this is from the piece. In an April 6th email, Alam Bokhari, who's Milo's like co-writer, mentioned having had access to an account of Yiannopoulos's with a password that began with the word crystal. Not crystal, C-R-Y-S-T-A-L, but K-R-I-S-T-A-L-L. Now, what's that, you ask? Kristallnacht, an infamous 1938 riot against German Jews carried out by the SA, the paramilitary organization that helped Hitler rise to power, is sometimes considered the beginning of the Holocaust. But that's not it. In a June 2016 email to an assistant, Yiannopoulos shared the password to his email, which began Long Knives 1290. The Night of the Long Knives was the Nazi purge of the leadership of the SA. The purge famously included Ernst Röhm, I don't know how to pronounce that, the SA's gay leader. 1290 is the year King Edward I expelled the Jews from England. Wow. So, look, I have to admit, I was a little naive on this, too. When I look at a guy like Milo, my thought was, well, it's obvious that he's, you know, a provocateur, if you will, which I think is a silly word, but it's an apt description of a guy like Milo. So I thought he was that, but I thought his whole point was, like, he's trying to get liberals and progressives angry and trying to provoke this, you know, over-the-top response, sometimes a violent response with riots and whatnot. But his whole thing was like, yeah, you know, I'm against the social justice warriors, and I'm just a fame whore, basically. That was my take on him. But no, according to these new revelations, it's that plus the fact that he might actually hold some, like, genuinely hateful, bigoted, white supremacist views. I mean, when you're calling the guy brilliant, who's the editor of the Daily Stormer, and you're hanging out with Richard Spencer and co, and they're making the Nazi salutes while you sing, and apparently your fucking password is Crystal, short for Kristallnacht, and Long Knives 1290, apparently maybe you do have some legit neo-Nazi sympathies, if not just outright being a neo-Nazi. So, yeah, I think, you know, these guys had a lot of people fooled. One of my friends had told me a while ago, like, no, I really had thought for a while that the alt-right was just about, like, you know, making fun of liberals who are oversensitive. But then he was like, oh, I think the light bulb moment for him was the Richard Spencer speech where he's talking about Lugan Pressa and saying Hail Trump and people in the audience are giving the Nazi salute. It was like a light bulb moment where he's like, oh, wait, shit. No, these are like white supremacists and neo-Nazis. And that's when he was like, I don't know how anybody can fucking look at these people and take them seriously. And now this is just further evidence to that effect, that that's what it is, but it's also like the so-called alt-light and the alt-right really work symbiotically. How do you say that? Symbiotically? And like Breitbart, for example, is just overtly playing footsies with them and sending articles to the editor of the Daily Stormer to say, do you like it? LOL, tee-hee-hee. Let's play footsies. Aren't the Jews terrible? Don't blacks and immigrants suck? Oh, yes. Ha-ha, triggered liberals, what? Oh, did I trigger you? Did I trigger you by doing my Nazi salute? Whoa, are you against Nazis? Is that what you are? Fucking virtue signaler snowflake. Look, bottom line, man, don't take these guys seriously. Like, I get it. Sometimes people on the authoritarian left, the actual left-wing snowflakes on college campuses, sometimes they make it easy to mock them. I get it. Everybody gets it. The fucking people with the blue hair, and they're like, oh, bro, I'm so complicated. Anyway, we should ban everybody who I dislike. Like, I get it. Those people are so easy to fucking mock, and it's easy to have a reactionary response to that and go, well, now I like these kinds of people, like Milo, who seem to make a point of triggering those people and getting them against him. But look, at when push comes to shove, what do they really stand for? If they just stand for triggering people, well, then that's vacuous. That's vapid. What do you actually believe? Some of them believe nothing. But then there's an even bigger question mark, which is some of them literally are white supremacists and neo-Nazis. And hey, if that's the kind of stuff you're into, by all means, but I think you're horrendously wrong and kind of stupid. And, you know, this is just more evidence to that effect here. Okay. All right, let's do one more, then we'll call it a day. Pew Research asked Americans if it's necessary to believe in God to be moral, and the results make me sad. So it says age, education gaps, on whether belief in God is needed in order to be moral. So in total, the percentage of people who say it's necessary to believe in God in order to be moral. Ready for this? 42%. Almost half of the American people say it's necessary to believe in God to be moral. That's so sad. And let's just think for a second, what's that number like in even less developed countries? I mean, that number has got to be ridiculously high in less developed countries. We're a pretty developed country, and 42% of our population, nearly half, so you have to believe in God to be moral. Now, granted, we're going to be on the lower end, if not the lowest, among other developed nations. So you do this poll in Scandinavia. You do this poll in Australia. You do this poll in the UK. They're going to be like, yeah, no, of course you don't have to be. But how sad is it that this is our country, 42% of people, you have to believe in God to be moral? That's just demonstrably untrue. So let me give you some more specifics here. 38% of men say it's necessary to believe in God to be moral, 46% of women, 35% of white people, 63% of black people, 55% of Hispanic people. Then when you go by age group, younger people are saving grace. 26% of young people say it's necessary to believe in God to be moral, 38% for age 30 to 49, age 50 to 64, it's 49%, and 65 and older, 57%. That's sad. And then obviously by education, the more education you have, the less likely you are to believe that you have to believe in God to be moral, the less education you have. Like if you have high school education or less, over half of them, 56%, say you have to believe in God to be moral. So, I mean, I don't even know how to respond to this other than to say, look, you know a lot of atheists. Even if you don't know that you know them, you know them. Atheists are your neighbors. Atheists are, you know, the person whose store you go to when, I don't know, you want some food. That would be a restaurant, asshole. An atheist owns the restaurant down the street. An atheist owns the grocery store. An atheist is your neighbor, is your buddy, the person who you talk to when you, I don't know, you go to the pool or you go play tennis or some shit. I don't know. We're everywhere. And, in fact, when you look at polling on the beliefs of atheists, more atheists believe in the philosophy of Jesus than Christians. So there are more atheists who say, hey, man, treat everybody good. Let's look out for the poor and the vulnerable. Let's give people health care and education. So atheists have a belief system, on average, that is more humanitarian than people who describe themselves as Christian. So we just say, we don't we don't need God to determine right and wrong. I know right and wrong based on the actions themselves. If I'm causing harm to people, if I'm doing something to somebody else that I wouldn't want done to me, I think that's immoral. I think that's unethical. But unfortunately, a lot of people hear, when you say, hey, man, I'm an atheist, what many people hear is, hey, man, I don't believe in right and wrong. Hey, man, I'm a nihilist. But that's not even unfair to nihilists, because you could be a nihilist in the sense that you don't believe in objective morality, but still say, hey, subjectively, you should act in a way that treats people good. So it's just sad that people interpret that as, oh, you don't believe in ultimate right and wrong. And no, I'm an atheist, I'm a non-believer, but I have a very strong moral compass that says I should treat people how I want to be treated. And people deserve education, people deserve health care, people deserve equal opportunity, people deserve a living wage. So what we need is a fucking PR campaign that lets Americans know atheists are everywhere. We're everywhere, and we have a strong moral compass, and your perception that we don't is just that. It's a perception based on negative stereotypes that are carried over from generations ago. And that perception has to go, because, yes, it is fair to call that bigotry. It's anti-atheist bigotry to just assume that if you don't believe in God, you are by definition immoral. Okay. All right. We are out of time, guys. Don't have enough time for the last story here. But I love you, baby. We will be back tomorrow. Not tomorrow. Tomorrow is Saturday. What the fuck are you saying? We will be back. We'll be back Monday. You know the deal. I love y'all. And everybody enjoy your weekend. And we'll see you then. Peace. Mwah.